Today is the 16th of September 2015. Today I'm interviewing Buster Harker, retired farmer of St. Lawrence Road, Ilsthorpe. He will tell us about the life and times of his family. Thank you, Buster.
Thank you, Frank. My father, Leslie Harker, was one of three brothers, Leslie, Cyril and Harry, who were all born in Napier and went to school at Napier Boys High. My father never told me anything at all about his father because he was ashamed of him, because his father walked out on the three boys and their mother when my father was about 10 years of age, and he disappeared into the pale blue yonder. He was a remittance man who came out from England early 1870s. He came from a family who lived in London, and their business was spice importers, and I think William Jarvis, my grandfather, was a bit of a problem to his family because they sent him out to the colonies, as they were called in those days, to see the back of him, I think. And sadly, my father and his two younger brothers saw the back of him too at the age of 10, 8 and 6. So that was a part of my history that I know nothing about. The little I do know is probably best forgotten. Sadly, my grandmother, Gertrude Sheath, married William Jarvis as a young woman. She was one of the Sheath family who were gunmakers in Birmingham, Hollis and Sheath. And Gertrude Sheath came out with her father, whose name was, I just forget for the moment, but he settled in South Canterbury, and having left the gun-making firm and brought his worldly goods with him, bought a sheep property in South Canterbury. But sadly, he knew nothing about farming and perhaps didn't think wisely enough to set up his operation with a manager. Perhaps there weren't too many managers about in the early 70s. But he lost the property, and he moved to Christchurch and built a two-storied home, which I saw many years later. But his farming operation apparently wasn't a success because it failed for him. Getting back to my own family, my father was born in 1886, and his two younger brothers each 2 or 3 years later. And my father left Napier Boys High in 1901, and he went to work at the port. He joined the Hawke's Bay Farmers. He started life in the wool stores there, and he had a great friend who was probably a schoolboy friend called Clive Fulton. And he and Clive Fulton used to sail their 16-foot centreboard dinghy, or sailing boat, I guess it was, on the inner harbour where the Napier Airport is now. It was a keen sailing area in the days before the earthquake, because there were, I think, something like 10,000 acres of water there. And perhaps I inherited his love of sailing later on, because I've had some very interesting voyages around the North and South Island and up to Fiji. And also I cruised on a 135-foot topsail schooner in the tall ships race. I joined the vessel as crew. Crew must have been very hard to find to sign me on in 1992, when I was 75 in the year 2000. So in 1992 I was 8 years younger, 67. I had a very interesting voyage. I joined this vessel, which was owned by David Blakely from Tauranga, and I joined it at Boston on the east coast of the United States and we sailed out of Boston Harbor, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, one of 200 ships, sailing vessels, ranging in size from 30 feet was the smallest, I think, and 200 plus was the largest, a four-masted sailing ship with a crew of 200. I was on a 135-foot topsail schooner with a crew of 9.
That must have been quite a sight to see 200 ships.
It was. It was a wonderful sight on a sunny afternoon when we left Boston Harbor. Night fell about 9 o'clock, and to our amazement, next morning there were only 11 vessels visible from the great mass of ships that left Boston Harbor the previous evening. And during the day, the vessels scattered over the horizon, all heading for Liverpool. And the following morning, which was 24 hours later, we didn't see any sailing vessel at all. And in fact, we didn't see any other vessel until we got to the Irish Sea. We sailed in calm weather, and to our surprise, I found out later that our skipper decided that his vessel, which he had built in Whangarei, it was a steel ship with a centreboard which could be raised and lowered by a winch. There were only 2 winches on board, one to raise the 12-ton centreboard and the other to raise the anchor. But the sails were raised by manpower. We set off in good weather, and the skipper, David Blakely, I thought rather recklessly, decided that the vessel would sail considerably faster without the drag of a centreboard. So the centreboard was fully raised, and we were getting along at 11 knots, which was quite a good speed for a vessel of that size in comparatively calm weather. And we sailed for the next 10 days across the North Atlantic with the centreboard raised all the way in good weather. We had one bit of excitement when the radio warned that there were icebergs about as we progressed further north beyond Newfoundland, and so the crews were advised to keep a sharp lookout for icebergs, because they do a lot of damage to a sailing ship if you happen to run into one. But I must say I got a little nervous. Next morning, after this warning, we had very foggy conditions and you could see probably 100 yards ahead. But we were moving into that fog at 11 knots, and I think we would have been pretty busy to avoid an iceberg if one had suddenly appeared out of the mist. But anyway, we never saw any icebergs, fortunately. And when we reached the Irish Sea, we ran into very heavy weather and high winds, and our skipper decided, with the full approval of his 8 crew members, to take shelter in a Welsh port, the name of which escapes me. So we ran for shelter into this port and tied up alongside and remained there for the next 2 days while the storm disappeared. We did this with the approval of the race organisers, because most other vessels which were in our area, although we didn't see any of them, they'd all taken shelter likewise. I'm sorry to say that I never got to finish the race with the crew at Liverpool, because I had a meeting arranged with my wife in London, and I'd run out of time to be on the ship and part of the crew. So I caught a train to London, and with the skipper's approval, I didn't jump ship. But when he got to Liverpool, he collected a prize, I think. I don't know if it was for the oldest crew or the smallest crew, but he was quite happy to be awarded a prize for the voyage which he had accomplished. He started his vessel, which had been built to his specifications in Whangarei couple of years beforehand, and the reason that he had it built with a centreboard, he had ideas of filling his ship with ewe mutton, which was available for something like $10 a carcass in 1992, and he had ideas of sailing up to the Fijian Islands and and selling it to the natives for possibly a small profit, and his vessel only drew about 4 feet of water with the centreboard raised fully, and so he was going to be able to get right in shore without worrying about coral reefs and so on. That's another story, and it never came to pass.
Well, now, coming back to your going to school, we've skipped a few years there.
Yes, we have. Yes, I only talked about where my father went to school and his brothers.
Yes.
From Waipakurau, I grew up and attended the convent school in Waipakurau. My first day at school was the Napier earthquake. I had two elder sisters and an elder brother, so I went comfortably, probably holding one of my sister's hands. We had about a 15-minute walk from our home in Racecourse Road.
Yes.
Waipakurau to St. Joseph's Convent School down in the near the river, the Tuk Tuk River.
Yes.
I thought school was quite a good place because I only had from 9 o'clock till 10:45, and the earthquake hit Hawke's Bay. And fortunately for my two elder sisters and elder brother, they were in the senior classroom, and it was just the end of playtime, and they were lined up ready to go back into the classroom when the earthquake came, which was a bit lucky for them because the front porch of the school, which was concrete porch, collapsed. And fortunately, none of the children were near enough to be injured. But because of the damage to the school and the general damage to Hawke's Bay, school closed for 2 weeks. So I thought as a little fellow of five that school was quite an exciting place because you only went to school for 2 hours and then you had a fortnight's holiday. One of the things that my father arranged for me as a youngster was to have music lessons, which was a good idea because family sing songs around the piano in 1930-31 and in those years was a great form of entertainment. But stupidly, after a couple of months of piano lessons, which were, I found, extremely difficult, and in reading the music seemed a lot of gobbledygook, I begged to be allowed to cease having piano lessons, and that was the end of my music lessons. Although later on, when I went to St. Pat's Silverstream as a boarder for 4 years, and I joined the... In 1939 was my first year at Silverstream. I think we had about 300 boarders and 50 day boys at St. Pat's in those days. Later on in the year, when the war broke out, were involved in cadet training. And so I got back into music at that stage because I was directed into the school band. And I learned to play the bugle, which had, unlike a trumpet, which has notes, that the bugle is just a blip.
Yeah. I know exactly what you say. Yes. It's just a straight pipe.
Yes. And I spent a couple of years in the school band, so apparently I had enough wind and kept using it in the right direction. But we very, very much enjoyed our cadet training because we used to do a lot of marching, and we also did a lot of digging at one stage because the school decided that we needed slit trenches in case later on in the end of 1941, when Japan came into the war, there was quite a bit of nervousness about possibility of the Japanese coming down. So we were all put on digging duties to dig slit trenches, and the school at Silverstream was built on river flats. The digging was very stony, very stony.
Did you play any sports while you were at Silverstream?
Yes, I started off the first year. We were graded according to our weight. I think my weight in 1939 was something like 5'7". So I was in they call it the fifth grade. I enjoyed playing rugby, and my time at school, although I moved into the fourth grade next year because that was what my weight had grown to, and the next 2 years I got up to the third grade for some reason best known to our coach. I was appointed the captain of the team, not because I was a good footballer, but I must have been quite useful at telling other people what to do. But I enjoyed my school days of rugby.
Your brothers and sisters went to the same school. They go to St. Pat's, your brothers?
I just had one brother, Peter, who was nearly 5 years older than me. He went to school in, let me see, he went to Silver Stream from 34 to 37. And you were saying, Frank, we both went to John Colton's funeral a couple of weeks ago. John Colton was he lived at Wanstead, and he went to Silver Stream the first year the school opened, 1931.
So he'd been the family were friends for that length of time. You knew him at the high school those days?
I didn't, because I didn't go to school till 39. Oh, I don't know what year John Colton joined the Air Force. Do you know?
No, I have interviewed him, but I can't remember now. It was at the beginning of the war.
My brother Peter, who left school in 37, he went farming. He started farming on a property at Bayview, which my father owned in partnership with his sister-in-law, Aunt Ella Harker from Wairoa. They bought a property at Bayview along the coastline and it's the property that is now the forestry.
Panpack.
It's where Panpack now is. Not very desirable property in those days, because it had lots of goats, which seemed to be able to cross from paddock to paddock. The goats used to run up the stays of the strainer post to get over.
I spent many a day helping farmers in that area shoot goats. Bayview was full of them.
My father and his brother Harry sold the farm. I don't know how long they'd had it, but my father went to work with Eric Tansey, who was the manager, after he left school. My father, who spent all his working life with the Hawke's Bay farmers, his first job was 1901 in the wool stores, and then he progressed to being a stock agent at the Dannevirke branch, and I remember being rather surprised when he told me he used to go out to interview clients on a motorbike, and he'd ride the motorbike along bush tracks where they had made a railway track so that they could push in wagons in there to get the timber out.
Yes.
In the Dannevirke district, which was full of good timber. But must have been a bumpy ride to ride a motorbike along a bush railway track. But while my father was working there as a young stock agent, he met and fell for my mother, who was one of five daughters and two sons of William Torrance Irvin. And he, like William Harker, had come out in the early 1970s on a sailing ship, and William Torrance Irvin landed in Dunedin.
That was 1876.
Yes, it was 18, the early 1870s. And William Torrance Irvin, grandfather, was an accountant in Dannevirke. And I remember being amazed when I said to my mother, who was born in 1889. She was 3 years my father's junior. I remember asking her what she and her sisters did after they left school. And she said, oh, we just stayed at home and helped mother. It was extraordinary to my mind that that happened as comparatively recently as...
Yes.
As... around 1900, but apparently the families with better education, it wasn't considered right to go out to work. Fortunately, that habit died a natural death, because it must have been awful to have a whole lot of young women hanging about the house.
That's right, yes. At least the mending and the washing and the cooking would all be done, wouldn't it?
Yes, it certainly would. It was such a waste of potential talent, wasn't it? Right, 1886, 1896. 1901, my father started work. He spent two or three years at the port of Napier in the wool stores, and then he was promoted to a stock department down at Dannevirke, and he spent a few years there. And in 1912, he was sent to Waipakarau, opened a branch of the HBF, and my father would have then been 26, so he must have been rather chuffed to be promoted to a managerial position. Rightly or wrongly, for him, he spent all his working life with the HBF, and when he retired in 1949, he had a staff of 50 at Waipakarau, and the branch that he opened, it had stock department, wool department. I remember as a kid playing after school out amongst the sacks of grain in the grain department. But I often used to, at my father's suggestion, after school I would call in at the office because he had told me he was going for a drive. He was a great one to drive out to see the clients rather than get on the phone and just talk. He used to like to visit them personally. And so I learned to drive. He started off allowing me at the age of 8 or 9 to sit between his legs in the 1925 Buick Tourer that he drove. And there was no power steering in those days. So steering at that age was only pretending to steer, really, because I needed the old man's help to get around the corner. But he would leave the office at 3 or 4 o'clock and drive out to Tikakino, by which time it was nearly dark, and I had a few lonely sessions waiting in the car, hoping that he'd cut his visit short. But I used to enjoy the drives with my father as a kid.
I'll just tell you a little story, give you a rest for a minute. My father used to go in when I was young on a Friday afternoon with my father. He used to meet his mates at the Carlton Hotel or the Pacific or different hotels, but he used to get grain ground at the Hawke's Bay Farmer's grain store for the pigs. So anyway, this particular day we went in and he would park me in the Grand Hotel in the snug and give the old ladies in the snug some money to buy me raspberry and lemonades while he was, you know, having his drinks down at the pub. Anyway, this particular day we arrived home late. My mother had already started milking the cows because we're dairy farmers, and he said he was sorry that he was late, but he had to wait for the grain to be crushed. And I said to him, but we picked the barley up at 11 o'clock this morning. He never took me again. Never, ever. That was the finish. Never split on your father. So carry on with your story.
At Silver Stream, I used to kid myself I was a bit of a runner. The best I ever did was come third in the senior cross country and third in the senior breaststroke, and I was captain of my rugby team for 4 years I was there, but I never got further than the third grade. Boys with any real talent used to get into the first 15, which was the ultimate for a schoolboy, if they were talented enough. By and large, from memory, though, they didn't put small fellas into the senior teams unless they were big enough to look after themselves. After leaving school, my father, who was still engaged in the stock and station business, he didn't, to my memory, he didn't consult with his boys what they would like to do when they left school. He had a great regard, and I suppose he also had an envy of farmers. Probably, he steered both his sons into farming, and I went to work after leaving school first of all for G.F. Kennedy at Hartuma, about 9 miles out from home. I used to go back to my parents' home usually at the weekend. I think I used to ride my pony the 9 miles back into Waipagra, and then after I saved up a few bob, I bought an old Panther motorcycle, and I was riding back to G.F. Kennedy's at Hartuma one Friday night. I think I'd been in with a few mates to go to the cinema, which was about the only entertainment in those days. And unfortunately, when I came out, I found my headlight wouldn't go. But I set off back to, I thought the moon will come out shortly, and I know the road pretty well. But I didn't get very far before I collided with a fellow who I actually knew. He was walking up to the sanatorium where he had a job. He was walking along Takapau Road. I hit him with the front wheel of the motorbike. That's how dark it was. I didn't see him. He heard me coming, and I said to him, "Why didn't you get out of the way?" He said, "I couldn't see. See, I didn't think you were so close." Anyway, I had a leather helmet on and leather gloves, but I gave myself a fair whack when I hit the road. And so I pushed the bike about only half a mile from the railway line in Waipakura. I pushed the bike back home and crawled into bed. And next morning I had a good-sized lump on my forehead. And so my parents took me to the doctor, and old Dr. Raymond in Waipakura decided I'd had concussion. And the recipe for concussion in those days was apparently go to bed for 3 weeks. So that buggered up my farm job with G.F. Kennedy, a nice man who I got on quite well with and learnt to drive the horse in the sledge and do all the things that farm boys do in their early days of farming.
Yes.
So after recuperating from a bump on the head, my father had been in touch with one of his clients. So my next job went out to Oakburn Station, 24 miles from Waipakura, to work for Peter Canning. And I spent the next 2 years learning shepherding and learning all about farming at Oakburn. Peter Canning, he was a man, I suppose, of about 50. And I heard later that he was very disappointed that he'd been manpowered to stay at home and run the property. Because he had three brothers, Robert, Walmsley and Jack, and they were in the Army, the Navy and the Air Force, and all serving overseas. So Peter Canning had a staff of one 18-year-old boy who didn't know very much.
That was you, was
yes,
it?
And a couple of Rarotongan boys, and Herbie Franklin, the head shepherd. And that was all the staff we had on 4,700 acres of hill country, which kept us pretty busy. And the first thing to do in the morning was to catch and saddle your horse at the stables, and then you'd go your various ways to do whatever the boss wanted doing that particular day.
So you stayed with him right throughout the war, or...?
No, I stayed with him for September 43 until I finally was accepted for the Navy in 1945. I had tried in 1944 to join the Navy, but they said come back when you're 19 and a half. So I finally got into the Navy in May 1945, just after the war ended. Sadly for me, it was disappointing at the time, but I suppose I was one of the lucky ones, because I put up a dismal record of service, 30 days in the Navy and 31 days leave, because I joined Scheme B, and 30 of us went to train at Motuhea Island in the Auckland Harbour, where they had a naval training school from 6:15 in the morning till 9:00 at night. We did everything at the double. So after 3 weeks there, we thought we were fairly fit. We slept pretty well at the end of the day, because having done everything at the double, which is running, everything you did, and the petty officers didn't have any mercy on slow runners. So we got the hurry up from them all day and every day, but we thoroughly enjoyed it. And then we went home for final leave for 10 days, and then we went back to the Auckland Domain, where we were accommodated in huts, and we were to board the Ruahini for England 10 days later. But in the meantime, VJ Day came along, August the 15th, and the Japanese surrendered, and so we went home on final leave, on discharge leave.
Discharge leave.
Having had final leave.
But you did join the Navy.
Yes, but it was a huge disappointment that we had joined too late to be of any help to anybody else. So then I probably made a mistake, because instead of branching out, either joining J-Force and going over to Japan, as some of the boys did, I went back to Oakburn for a couple of years. So that was another mistake, I guess, I made, instead of going to another boss in another place. But that they welcomed me back, and I guess I must have been quite content to go back to the place that I knew.
Just a question. What happened to the chap you ran into with the motorbike? You didn't kill him, did you?
No. No. Fortunately, I was going very slowly because it was dark and the moon that I was promising to come out, it wasn't doing the right thing at all. I never rode a motorbike without lights again.
No.
Because Oakburn was 24 miles southeast of Waipakurau.
Well, that's almost Porongahau, isn't it?
Yes. And the asphalt in those days didn't last very much after you left Waipakurau. The asphalt soon ran out, and then it was gravel all the time, all the way, which was quite tricky, but the answer seemed to be to keep your speed down and you could generally stay on the bike.
Yes, the old Panther was a Panther 500cc?
No. It seems ridiculous, but I can't remember what the cc was. But
they were just a big single banger, weren't they? Single cylinder.
Might have been.
Most of them were 500cc. It's a huge pot and long stroke, and they weren't that easy to kick over either. Sorry, carry on with, you were back at Oakburn for a couple of years, and where did you go to from there?
Once again, I'm sorry to say, I consulted my father, and I got a job working on Larry Sheriff's property out of Utiku, which is south of Taihape. Larry Sheriff had an Angus stud. So I went to work for him for 18 months in 1940. The war ended in August 45, so I must have been back at Oakburn for 3 years, because in 1948 I went to, by this time I upgraded my transport, bought a Model T Ford. It was. It cost me a whole $20, which I bought it at the end of the war. I remember going out one Sunday morning and finding I used to visit a family at Porongahau Beach, and the Board family, Sid Board, had two attractive daughters, and they used to have tennis parties, and that was a very pleasant part of life after work. At the weekends, the Board's property was alongside the Porongahau River, where we could do a bit of boating if somebody had a boat, and a bit of eeling too. But moving on to when I went to Taihape, the Model T Ford, amazingly enough, would find its way through the Manawatu Gorge and through Fielding and up to through Mangaweka and up north to Utiku, and then out to the sheriff's farm, which was close to the Ruahini Ranges, which strangely enough was Utiku was over the Ruahinis from Waipakurau. I always thought about taking the short way home on foot, but I never got around to doing it.
Yes,
the old Model T Ford, it didn't have a gear lever. It had three pedals. If you wanted to go in reverse, you'd push the middle pedal, and that would engage the rear movement. And it didn't have a accelerator. It had a hand lever.
That's
throttle.
Right.
But it took 5.5 hours to drive from Waipakurau to the farm at Utiku. But it was a very trusty steed, the Model T Ford. I had a happy time working for Larry Sheriff. There was usually another fellow of similar age to myself, and we shared a batch. Mrs. Sheriff fed the two boys, so we were pretty lucky in that we dined with the family. The 18 months I spent there, I joined the Taihape Old Boys rugby team, junior old boys they were, and I used to play rugby in the winter time on Saturday afternoon. Have the odd beer with the lads. Usually finish up going to either a local dance or more often than not the cinema. The family were very good to their young staff because they used to include us when they had a tennis party. they would include the two boys on the staff. The fact the boss had three daughters was quite a help to fraternize. And then my next move, after 18 months feeding the bulls, apart from ordinary stock work on the farm and shepherding the sheep and farming the cattle, working amongst the stud stock took up quite a bit of our time, teaching the calves to lead and so on. But after 18 months there, my brother Peter had gone into partnership with my farmer, with my father, to buy a property which was actually sold to them by Morris Chambers from Havelock North. He had a farm at Aria, southwest of Pikuiti, and Peter was up there farming as a bachelor, and he persuaded me to go up and work with him, which I did then from early 1950 to 1951. That was farming different country, in a different climate, in a different part of the world. While I'd been at Tehachapi, I joined the Otahappy Ski Club. I became friendly with some of the local Tehachapi people, who persuaded me to join their ski club, and we used to go up at weekends and learn to ski.
Was Tuaroa open then?
No, it wasn't. But it was quite a major to go either with in your vehicle or somebody else's vehicle. Sometimes the ski club used to organise a truck to take a team of so-called workers and so-called skiers up the mountain for Saturday night, sometimes Sunday night, or if you could persuade the boss to give you Saturday morning off, get away up there on Friday night. And we had some very happy times there to look back on. Te Marae, southwest of Aria, was about, from memory, 20 odd miles southwest again of Tikuiti. Te Marae was on the Mokau River, which was 35 miles from the sea on the west coast, and Dick Lufton, who was the next door neighbour, used to spend a lot of time white baiting when he probably should have been farming, but he used to catch white bait by the kerosene tin bulls. So for a couple of bachelors living in a corrugated iron cottage, which was the homestead on Te Marae, we used to enjoy when Dick Lufton had surplus white bait. But I found it quite amazing that the white bait would progress 35 miles up the river. The time I spent on Te Marae, Bob Batley was a married man on the property, working for Peter, or with Peter, and I remember we had a huge totara tree which stood, I could just see over the top of it. It was a fallen tree, mostly heart totara, and Bob and I were splitting posts out of this totara tree, the cross-cut saw which we were using to cut the 6-foot post lengths. It was a long way, the cut, from a five foot six log. It was always a sigh of relief when you finally got to the bottom. Had a brief spill before you started on the next leg. But another exciting thing that I used to do with Bob, who was the married shepherd on the property, he was a great pig hunting enthusiast, and there were wild pigs on the property, and it was a lot of fun going on horseback on your day off to try and go with the dogs. And somebody had seen the pigs had been rooting the day before, and we'd usually get a pig and bring it home either on the pack horse, or if you didn't have the pack horse with you, put it up on the saddle with you and head off home with it. But wild pork was always a treat in the oven, and was generally pretty popular change from usually ewe mutton,
which
we used to eat. While I was up at Te Matai for 18 months, I joined the Ruapehu Ski Club, which later in life, when I got married in 1955, which is 5 years on, I couldn't wait to join up my wife and then the family when they arrived. And skiing has been a very attractive and worthwhile sport for all the family. And my three grandsons now in 2015, my three grandsons have all, and my son Jeremy, they've all qualified as, they've got their ticket as ski instructors. So skiing has been a very exciting sport for all the family. Jeremy's youngest son, Willie, who's now a man of 19, a couple of years ago he learnt to do a somersault on his skis while skiing downhill, do a back somersault and land on the skis and carry on. Sadly, I gave up skiing in 1979. At the age of 79, Caroline, my daughter, had taken me on a ski expedition. I was farming at Ilthorpe and she was living down south, and she took me on with a ski party of about 20 friends. They had the exclusive use of this lodge at Mount Olympus, and the only ski tow there was a rope tow, and we had nutcrackers to hang on to the rope. We had a very happy week there, but I unfortunately, I was standing still on top of a knob in the sunshine talking to somebody, and my feet, we were not moving, but my feet went from under me, and I landed hard on my hip and didn't think too much of it. But when I had my shower at the end of the day, I found I had a decent sort of a bruise. And I had that bruise when I got home for about 6 weeks, and in the end I couldn't get rid of it until the doctor put a needle into it and drew out a whole lot of infection which got rid of the bruise and so on. And so I decided that from 1948, I guess I started skiing when I worked at Taihape. I'd had 31 years skiing. I just decided to give it away.
You were at your brother's farm.
Yes. So I decided I needed a change from farming. So a friend and I, in 1951, finally, with the help of Kirkpatrick, who was the manager of the Tamona Freezing Works, he finally put in a word with the captain of a cargo boat for me, and my mate and I signed on as crew. I'm forgetting to say that we decided we wanted to go overseas, and we didn't want to go as passengers because we thought that was unduly expensive. So we thought we'd sign on as crew. And we went to Gisborne and we went to Wellington, and we even went to Auckland, I think, because the story was that often crew jumped ship in New Zealand. And if you were on the wharf on the day of sailing and they suddenly found that they were short of crew, if you were there and looked ready, willing and able, you could sign on on a vessel. Anyway, my mate and I finally got fed up with going to Napier and to Wellington and to Gisborne to stand by to get a job on a ship. finally, I think Alec Kirkpatrick put in a word for us, and we signed on the Trojan Star out of Napier, and away we went to England for, I think, a shilling a day. We had an exciting voyage on the Trojan Star. We signed on, so one of us was a deck boy working with the ordinary seamen, painting and doing things that deckhands do on a cargo boat. And the other one was a pantry boy, and we were weak about. One was on deck and one was in the pantry. And on one occasion, we were going across the Pacific to Panama. The ship was rolling so much that the plates in the galley were sliding from one end of the... As the ship rolled, any plates which weren't being held were sliding up and down the table, and then when she rolled the other way, they were sliding the other way. We thought that was quite fun until one of the crew said, "Well, I reckon she's rolling 38 degrees, and if she goes a little more past 40 degrees,
it's all over.
She won't come back." However, it took us 6 weeks to get across the Pacific, through the Panama Canal, across the Atlantic to the London docks, and it was a tremendous lot of fun. The two of us had a cabin, but we lived and dined in the sailors' mess, and they were a lot of characters. And some of them said, "Well, when you get to England, come home and stay with us for a day or two." And I always regretted afterwards that we never did that. But we had friends in London who we were looking forward to catching up with. And instead of going with the seamen up to their homes to see where they lived and meet their family and so on, we stupidly said, "We're sorry, we can't do that. We've got to catch up with our mates in London." So we signed off as crew in England and caught up with our mates and made arrangement to stay in the flat with usually a group of half a dozen New Zealanders, and like all young people who first get to London, we marvelled at all the excitement of the city and the history and everything about England that was new to us. And we arrived in England on the 11th of November 1950, and I can honestly say we didn't see the sun for 3 months, and it didn't really bother us. It didn't rain all the time, but There were an awful lot of grey days. We got a job in a box factory at High Wycombe at one stage, making boxes. I think from memory they were beer boxes rather than cardboard cartons. And that job for a few weeks got us out of all the temptations of doing nothing in London, and topped up our savings. I stayed there for nearly 12 months. My parents arrived with their daughter, and they rented a house at Wimbledon. So I joined them, and my father took delivery of a new car, which was an Austin 70. And I went travelling with them. This was in May, but no, I'm forgetting. In January, I got the opportunity of going across to the continent and had a ski holiday in Austria with a group of about 10 New Zealanders who went in two cars, driving from London south on the ferry to France, and then we travelled across France into Austria. And My place was in the dicky seat of a Ford three-seater, three in the front and two in the dinghy seat. And in the winter time, that was quite a drafty trip. We had a very exciting skiing holiday with a group of New Zealanders, some of whom were Rex Sinclair, who recently died in Auckland. His father was a doctor in Taihape, and Rex had grown up in Taihape, and I'd first met him in the ski club, Taihape Ski Club, and then later on at the Ruapehu Ski Club. He was continuing his medical training in England, and Bruce Craig was another one who later became a doctor in Invercargill. But they were part of this group of about 10 New Zealanders who went to Austria for a ski holiday for a fortnight. Then later on, when my parents arrived, they gave me the opportunity of travelling around Scotland and Ireland with them. My sister and her friend and I sometimes would put my parents would book into accommodation, either a farmhouse or a country pub. We three younger ones would often just rig up a canvas awning from the car and blow up our Lilos, I think we had.
Yes.
We'd do it on the cheap if the weather was reasonably kind, and we saw a lot of the country, England, Scotland and Ireland. We travelled for several weeks like that. And then later on in the year, when it came time to head back home and get on with the work of life, applied for a job with Dalgetty's to take care of livestock being exported to New Zealand and Australia on a ship. The thing was, they would sign on young farming types, usually a couple of you, to look after the stock. We had sheep and cattle on deck. So that was how I got back home again. You were signed on to take care of the livestock on board, feed them and muck them out, and generally take care of them. That was an adventure in itself, because we on the cargo ships, so they generally call at various ports to load or offload cargo, and the crew would get ashore and see the sights, keep out of trouble as much as possible. The best way to keep out of trouble was to run in the opposite direction if trouble blew up.
So you eventually got back to New Zealand?
Yes, I'm just trying to put a date on it. Yes, I got back to New Zealand and went to work. My father had bought a farm in my name, to my surprise, while I'd been away. No, he actually bought a farm in the latter years of the war, or at the end of the war. He bought a farm in my name, and I said, what about my brother who's just spent all these 5 years in the Navy? Father's theory was that Peter would qualify for rehab, so I was always a bit embarrassed that the farm was bought in my name. So when I got back from the overseas trip, I went to work out there, which was 38 miles from Waipakurau, up at the top of the Mangarapa Road, and I worked out there with the manager who was on the property for a while. But shortly after that, he got his own property just a few miles down the road, and then I was on my own. So I spent a couple of years there, 52 and 53. Then I'd met a young lady who I suggested matrimony to her, but to my surprise and disappointment, she got on a ship and went to England to work for a year.
Oh dear, left you in the sticks.
Yes, that was very disappointing at the time, but we kept in touch with each other. That happened in 1954. She was in the UK for a year. We corresponded while she was away, and for better or worse, she came home in January 55, and we were married in April 55, and we've now just celebrated our 60th wedding anniversary.
And so when you were married, you were at the station?
No. I was on Putahi Farm, as it was called, the top of the Mangarapa.
That was pretty high country there, wasn't it?
Yes, it went up to the top of Taputai, as it was called. Taputai Hill. It's the highest hill in the...
Some years ago I went out to Bay de la Tour, had a property close to there somewhere, and I couldn't believe how high it was. I had to climb up to the shearer's quarters where this... I went out to buy some white ducks for my pond on the farm. It's quite steep country out there, isn't it?
Yes, it is. When my brother... I was at Putahi Farm for a couple of years. My brother Peter was there and my sister Gretchen was housekeeping for him while I was in England. And Peter on one occasion on Taputai, which is the big hill which goes up at the end of the Mangarapa Road, got blown off his horse. Can really blow at Prongahau.
Now that was the farm that your father bought you, was it?
Yes, so when he handed over to me, I picked up the mortgage, and so I was very fortunate to be given that start in life. But while I was up the Mangarapa on Putahi Farm, got to hear of this property up the St Lawrence Road, which was a Glasgow lease, and I remember taking Eric Tansey, who had been my father's manager out at Bayview before the war.
Mm.
And Eric Tansey later became a valuer with the State Advances Corporation. And I took him for... I heard of this property, which was up for sale, a leasehold property on St Lawrence Road, and Eric Tansey came for a ride around it with me, and he gave it the thumbs down because it was a leasehold property. But I saw it as a great opportunity to get a leg in on a property much more centrally situated than the back end of Prongahau. I just can't recall exactly how we did it, but we arranged to sell Putahi Farm and purchase Pine Bush from Waddy Watson, Petongata, or St Lawrence Road at the same time. You know, often when properties change hands, one depends... depends on the sale of the previous property. But we managed to tie it all together. Rosalind, my new bride, came to Putahi Farm for only 3 weeks, and it was time to take over the new place just when she came on board. So the excitement was really mounting then. I had a new wife and a new farm.
Yes, I can imagine. Was it a totally broken-in farm?
No. No, it had been farmed as part of St Lawrence Station for many years.
Right.
And Waddy Watson, who I bought from, he'd taken on the lease. I think he had worked on St Lawrence Station and he'd taken on the leasehold when it became available, as about six different properties on St Lawrence Road had that arrangement. They were all part of the original St Lawrence. And we paid rental to the Williams Trust, and we did that quite happily for 11 years because we were only paying just a few dollars a year per acre rental. But after 11 years, we got the opportunity to buy the freehold. So five or six properties there, adjoining properties, all took up the chance of buying the freehold, except one continued to Ross Withers, who was up the end next to Mangatapuri Station. He continued with the rental system. So, moving on, we learnt to be husband and wife, as you do when you're first married, because I think, like many of people of our age, we never shared a bed until we were married.
That's right.
Unlike today, they don't even bother to marry. That seems to be widely accepted as okay.
So you had, how many children did you have?
Yes, well, we were blessed with one son and three daughters. And Jeremy was our oldest firstborn, And he arrived 10 months after we were married, and so that was a whole new adventure for us.
Yes.
And then the girls followed 18 months later, and then 2 years later, and then 8 years later. And we lived in the farm cottage, which was, looking back on it, it was horribly, horribly cold in the winter. But when you're reasonably young, you just put an extra blanket on the bed if you're cold.
Yes, you live with the cold.
You do, but it's surprising how we put up with the cold, because when you went up in the ceiling on the farm bungalow that we lived in for 11 years, there was no building paper under the iron. And on a frosty night, you could hear the drips into the ceiling. You've had that experience,
yes, Frank. Absolutely, yes.
Roz was always rather surprised. After 11 years, we succeeded in building a new home. And so when we did that, we put a married couple into the farmhouse that we had lived in. And Roz says that as soon as the married shepherd's wife mentioned that it was pretty cold, we put in a heater, you know, one of those heaters you have concrete blocks in.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And they're very effective.
Yes.
Roz always wondered why we hadn't put one in one when we lived there.
And so your children would have gone to Elsthorpe School, or...?
Yes, our son and three daughters went to Elsthorpe School from 1960 up until about 1970, 75, when the last of them went to boarding school. But we had a very happy life growing up, and we had a happy life in Elsthorpe. Roz had a hand in getting Pony Club going out there, and I served my time on the school committee as chairman of the school committee, and I was even chairman of the National Party for a while, like you were, Frank. We were always disappointed when the local MP, John Falloon, used to come to our annual meeting, but on one or two occasions, he'd ring up at the last minute and say he couldn't make it. And he was fairly careful, because we used to have him at the Hawke's Bay show, and I was on the committee there for 25 years.
Right.
And we'd put a raffle book in front of him, but he never had any money.
I worked with all those politicians. They were all the same.
Were they?
Yes, they were fair weather friends.
Yes.
Yeah, it was funny, really. Election year, they were right beside you. They were so good friends, because they wanted the money and they wanted the membership and all that. But once they got elected, I don't ever regret the time I gave the National Party, because I was a divisional councillor and I did lots of things within the system. We tried to change, you know, I thought I could influence the party to change Muldoon's direction. But after a while I got to know Muldoon quite well, and he wasn't such a bad fellow. But anyway, that's another story.
Yes, it is. After 35 years of sheep farming, I never had an interesting conversation with a mob of ewes yet, or heard of cattle. But when we walked the Milford Track with a couple of friends in 1970, Roz said, wouldn't it be great to come back here one day and spend more time? And I remembered her having said that, and I had a rather crazy idea at one stage of selling the farm at St. Lawrence Road. I heard of a property that was coming up on the market in the Wairarapa.
Mm.
It'd be twice the area, and I thought possibly twice the potential, and similar outlay. So I set the wheels in motion with the idea of putting the farm on the market and shifting camp to the Wairarapa. But at the last minute, this fella changed his mind and decided he wasn't going to sell.
Mm.
So I found that rather unsettling at the time. And then the idea of applying for a job on the Milford Track to have a change from farming. Roz said she wondered if I had the equivalent of the male menopause. Anyway, I wrote to the Milford Track authorities. It used to be run by THC.
That's right, yes.
They said, if you come down here, we'll have a look at you and we'll see if you're suitable for running one of our huts. And I said, well, can't we see somebody in the North Island? It's a hell of a long way to go down here, down there, just on the off chance. So they said, yes, we could. If you come to Wellington, we'll interview you there. So went down there and said to them, well, if a hut keeper's job on the Milford Track comes up, we'd like to take it on. And we said we'll do it as a husband and wife, hut keeper and cook, and three daughters will be the hut staff. We also said that we'd like to employ our own staff rather than you just send us Tom, Jack and Dick on my kikamuka.
Yes, yes.
We'll employ our own staff. And they said, we couldn't let you do that unless the staff guaranteed to stay for 3 weeks minimum. Anyway, we got the job at Pompilona and some of our friends thought I had a screw loose, and the other 50% said, "Oh, I'd love to do something like that, but I can't get away." Well, of course you can't because you're locked into farming. So, with the upset of thinking about getting a bigger property and then it falling through, I was a bit unsettled in my mind, I suppose. But we went down to Pompilona and we loved it because you couldn't have a bigger change from sort of lifestyle of being a servant of the sheep and cattle.
What age were the children at that stage?
The girls were both, one was at varsity and the other one was just about to start.
Yes, yes.
And Pip, the youngest, was 12, so she could only come in the school holidays. But Sally, the second one, she said, I'm not going to bury myself on the Milford Track from November to February. And I said, I'm sorry, Sally, but we've taken this job on as a family operation, and you've got to come. We need you. And she came feeling reluctant about it, but she was the one who rang us up in July next year and said, let's do it again. She had a boyfriend who she recommended we get as a trackman, because we had two trackmen and two hut girls, and Ros and I were hut keeper and cook, so it was a staff of six, you see, at each hut. But Steve Hanna was the trackman, and she and Sally married later on, and are still happily married, and to our pleasant surprise, they have a nice home in Wellington at Seatoon, just looking out over the harbour where the ferries go past. Yeah. They amazed us by ringing us up one couple of weeks ago and they said, just bought a home in Tiawonga.
Oh.
And we're selling a business in Wellington and selling the home, and we hope to be moving up in February or March. They've got quite a number of friends there already. So she was talking to some of her friends the other day, and they said, "Oh, we've got a place in Hawke's Bay, and we've got a house at Tiawonga." And Sally said, "Yes, but I'm the only one that was born in Hawke's Bay."
So how long did you go to the Milford then?
Oh well, we did it for 3 years.
Yes.
For three summers, and we leased our farm to a neighbour, who was the farm manager on the on St. Lawrence Station, a chap called Don Smith. And we leased the farm and we sold the stock to him. And so we had to buy the stock back when we started farming again after 3 years.
Yes.
But that worked out all right. But it was a wonderful existence down there because, you know, farming in many ways in the country, when you especially when you're back a bit down the arse end of Prominhow, for instance, it's a can be quite a lonely life, and you're very dependent on your own family and the need to get along with each other. But it opened up a whole new life for us because we'd get a call on the radio to say from THC boss, he'd say we've got the Questers Tours and Travel sending their group up the track tomorrow. Give them a hand and do anything you can to help, because they have another tour in February. And you know, these were a group of 24, I think, which was more than half the party. So what we said, okay, we'll do our best. So without the other members of the team sort of feeling that they were being neglected in any way, we just went out of our way to be pleasant to these people. And so they used to send two student graduates from America with the party. And so they said, thanks very much for looking after us. We'll see you again in February when we'll be back. So when they came back in February, I took these two 20 and 21-year-old university graduates who were looking after the party of birders. Yes. They were birding enthusiasts, Questers Tours and Travel clients. I said, this is bloody ridiculous, you two American lads showing the party through my country. I could do it far better. And they said, well, if you think you can, you better get in touch with our boss. So I got in touch with the boss by mail and by telephone, and generally made a nuisance of myself for a couple of years. We were still on the track. Anyway, when we came off the track, I was still niggling away to Questers Tours and Travel. So, to my pleasant surprise, they sent out Woody Hartman, who was he is tour leader, but they named me as tour leader, and Woody Hartman was assistant. So I got to be the tour leader around New Zealand of Questers Tours and Travel for this group. And they had a wonderful tour through New Zealand. Questers did. They landed in Auckland, flew to Bay of Islands, had two nights up there, then flew to Rotorua, two nights there doing the birds and the scenery in that district, and then flew to Mount Cook, two nights there.
Were you with them?
Yes. It was a 17-day tour. Then fly to Tiano, walk the Milford Track, which is 5 nights, fly to Stewart Island, 2 nights there, then fly to, from Stewart Island back to Christchurch, 2 nights there, and we used to take them out to the big birds at Banks Peninsula, and then away.
What a trip.
Yes. Well, and I organised with the boss that Ros could join us. She joined us, I think, 2 nights in Rotorua, 2 nights at Mount Cook, somewhere else. And when Hartman went back to the States, he said Harker would be all right, so long as Ros is not far behind. And the very next tour, they sent 24 of their people, and Ros and I were the tour leaders. So we went through New Zealand with them. See, it only took us away from the farm for 17, 18 days. By this time, after 35 years there, we'd cranked the farm up a bit so we could afford to have a married man. So, you know, we weren't neglecting our home base.
No. Oh, that's...
But the icing on the cake was when I persuaded the boss to, I said, instead of THC doing all your New Zealand bookings, I said, well, we've just formed New Zealand Nature Expeditions as tour operators, licensed tour operators. I said, why don't we do the bookings? And he said, the boss in New York said, well, you give us a quote. So we did our sums and gave him a quote. And they said, he came back to us and this was by fax, I think, in those days,
yeah, sure.
rather than email.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, your price is bigger than THC's price. I said, well, if you tell us THC's price, we'll match it. Anyway, the long and the short of it was we got to do the bookings. And, of course, that's where the cream is.
Mm-hmm.
Because the accountant said, our accountant said, you're only charging 10%. You're only making 10% on all this work you're doing. We think you should make it 20%, which we did. And so long as we did the job properly and people felt satisfied that they'd got fair value for money, everybody was happy. So each year from 1983, we left the Milford track in 78. We were on the Milford track for those 3 years. And then I think we did our first Questis run in 81. So it was a three-year time lag. But we did it every year with them, twice a year, November and February, walking the track. Until Questis gave up in 2000. So we had 20 years with them, really.
Yes.
Then when Questis packed it in, I started, my nephew, Nick Harker, Peter's son, farms it. My brother Peter died 15 years ago. Nick, his son, who's similar age to our son Jeremy, he farms Peter's property now, or since his father died. And he's married to Birgit, a Danish girl, and they have a family of four, and the parents come out every year to see them. And I said to Henry, who I get on with like a house on fire, I said to him, you come all the way from Denmark and then you fly back again. That set Henry thinking. And damn it all, next year he got in touch and said, right, I'm getting 16 or 18 people together. You plan a tour around New Zealand for us. And so for 12 years in a row, Henry and I, we hired a 42-seater bus, usually from Waipawa Buses,
yes,
who I know well, because...
Yes.
And Henry and I drove it cheaper than paying a driver.
You had a bus license?
Yes. And for the Questis people that Henry brought, once they arrived here, all their meals were included. Even when we were travelling, we always had two nights stays.
Yes, sure.
Because, you know, any holiday with one night stay is just hard work. Or always two night stays, sometimes three nights. And if Henry and I, or if we felt that a place was a bit of a fizzer, we'd fine-tune it so that next year we wouldn't use it. And we finished up with a 26-day tour from North Auckland to Stewart Island and during the West Coast.
So you're really a tour operator?
Well, we still get a consideration from the tax department, because when Henry stopped coming, actually the last two or three years that they did it after my 12-year stint, they did it with Henry's daughter, and she sort of took over with Henry what we'd been doing because she speaks Danish.
Sure, sure.
So that was fine. So Ros informed Rosak Travel, and she did. She's had the RHS, the garden group from England, around New Zealand gardens two or three times over the years, and she's taken New Zealand groups to Australia, and she's also taken New Zealand groups to France and Italy a number of times. You'd think that I must have twisted questions around my little finger, but we suggested to them that Ros and I went to Australia and did their route at our own expense, to make ourselves familiar with the Australian birds, of which there are bloody hundreds, 800 I think. Maybe we could do the Australian tour as well. Mm. So we did the Australian tour for several years, and also the Hawaiian itinerary we did several times for Questus, and that's very nice, the Hawaiian tour, because they fly to the three different islands, and Questus only had the best available accommodation.
Gosh, that's incredible to know. Yep. It all was happening from a little village in Havelock.
But it all started from Milford Track, you
yes,
see.
Yes, I know.
A lot of my mates thought I'd, you know, Harker must have gone off his nut. Fancy going down and being a hut keeper on the Milford.
See, lots of people think about doing these things, but they never do them, do they?
Well, between ourselves, I think some of them are bogged down in the fact they went to Wanganui Collegiate or Christ College, and you know, that's become their whole existence.
I did something a few years ago when I was 70. I thought there were several things I haven't done. One was to learn the mandolin, and the other one was to buy a motorbike and ride it to Invercargill and to Northland. And I bought the motorbike first, a big white Honda 650, and the family and all my friends thought I'd gone mad. Absolutely. Have you going back to... I said, no. Anyway, I've done all those things, and it's been the most wonderful experience I could have ever had. Of course, my grandkids were in Winton at that stage in Southland, so I had a reason to ride down that way, and my other kids were in Auckland. So, yeah, it was great, but, you know, it's... There's nothing I've done I regret doing. I'm pleased I did them. So anyway, during this, you were farming, and of course, you were obviously doing other things. You said you did quite a lot of sailing. Was that while the children were younger, or...?
No, sometimes I would take a week off from the farm and join a good sailor with a good 40-foot keeler, you know, sloop rig keeler, and I've enjoyed sailing with him, sometimes out of Napier, sometimes out of Auckland. I've been round the North Island and round the South Island. Had the nice experience of sailing, joining him at Milford, and sailing into the fjords where Captain Cook used to rest up and so on. Yeah. Learned a bit about sailing on the way. I talked earlier about crossing the Atlantic.
Yes, the Boston trip. But so, you know, you've really been, always had a hankering for the outdoors. You probably never ever knew when you were younger that you had this urge, did you?
No, perhaps not. Of course, you get to love the outdoors in the farming life, I think. Thinking back, two of my farming friends finished up their life committing suicide, which is an awful waste, isn't it? And I hope it's not going to happen to dairy farmers, because some of them must be backs to the wall these days.
I see they've got another rise in price at the sale this morning, didn't they, overnight? I can't remember how much it was.
Well, perhaps that turned the corner.
Well, yes, but the quantities are not... It's because the Fonterra is not putting so much out on the market. They've reduced the amount available, and so that obviously has some bearing.
Lifted the price.
So then you carried on with all your other entrepreneurial interests. You still carried on farming. You farmed until 1993, was it?
Yes, we handed over to Jeremy then.
And so you retired to Reeve Drive, Havelock North.
We handed over to Jeremy in 93.
Yes.
But we stayed. Well, I worked for him, and we didn't wean ourselves away from Pine Bush until 97.
How big was Pine Bush?
1043 acres.
Oh, it's a good-sized farm.
Yep. Yeah, it's a good-sized farm, but, you know, only 100 acres of flat, 300 acres of arable, and the rest hill.
So you must have backed onto the Tookie Tookie.
No, there's another property.
Oh, is there?
Yes. The stream which comes down, the Markra stream which comes down through Ilthorpe and down St. Lawrence and Pine Bush, and it runs into the Tuktuk.
Mm.
But there's another property called, partly St. Lawrence and partly what is now Guy Bill's farm. He bought from the Smiths a property which is between us and the Tuktuk. Oh. I'm waiting for a cataract operation.
I knew there must be a reason why you weren't playing so well.
Well, you know, our little TV set is only about 8 feet away from where we sit in the evening.
Yes.
But, you know, if we're watching it, we've been watching tennis just the last few days.
Mm.
I can't read the score, you know, which is in big writing.
Yeah.
It's a blur.
Really needs the,
I'm hoping the cataract operation will change all that.
Oh, yes, I'm sure it will.
Have you had it?
No, but I know people that have.
Apparently it makes all the difference.
In fact, I subscribe to a chap over in the islands who does cataract operations all the time. I send $25 a month. What's his name? He's a New Zealander who did all the cataract operations on the cheap. He does them $25 a head. And I got a letter today to say about this photo of this chap who I've given sight to, so he's able to go back to work. It's amazing.
Oh,
$25 a time.
Is that a fact?
Yes. And there are about several thousand here. But anyway, that's fascinating, really. This story is amazing. Two things I haven't asked you. Number one is, and I did ask you, but I need you to tell me, how did you get the nickname Buster?
I had two eldest in a family. I was the fourth out of five children, and my two older sisters were 10 years and 7 years older than me, and for some reason they hung the name of Buster on me when I was about 3. I don't know if it had anything to do with Buster Keaton, who was perhaps in the movies on those times, but that's how it started.
It's certainly stuck, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
And the other thing is your age at the time of interview.
Oh, 90 years and 4 months. My birthday was, we celebrated our 60th wedding anniversary with the family and about 10 close friends, most of whom had been at our wedding, and 38 cousins and husbands and nieces and nephews and grandchildren. So we built a new home on the farm in 1965. My father started the Waipagrau Wine and Spirit Company with his friend Frankie Dunn, who was an accountant in Waipagrau. He told me they put up £50 each, and they got a liquor license to form the Waipagrau Wine and Spirit Company. And my father died in 1954, and my brother took over being a director.
Mm.
My father died from a heart attack at the age of 67.
Mm.
And Peter carried on with Frankie Dunn's widow. They were both directors, but she was a difficult woman and difficult to work with. And Peter was farming up in the King Country and had enough, I think. And she was bending over backwards to buy out our share, which she eventually did. So my younger sister died at the age of 26 from a heart problem, which could have been fixed, you know, now, but it killed her. So Peter agreed to sell our half of the business for £80,000. So each of the four of us got £20,000. Which enabled us to build a new home on the farm.
Mm.
I started to say a few minutes ago that one of the real joys of what we did on the Milford track was that we arranged with the boss that we would employ our own staff if he would allow us, and he decreed that they had to stay at least a minimum of 3 weeks, otherwise there's too much bookkeeping with turning the wage book on and off. So we were able to invite some of our not-so-young friends like ourselves as couples, sometimes as couples. The oldest ones we ever had was my sister and her favourite cousin, and when they came, they were women, and Otie de Chateau, my cousin, died last year at the age of 99. So last year was 2014. We were on the Milford track in 76, 77, 78. You can work it out.
It's a long time.
They were grandmothers. Yes. Both grandmothers when they came down.
Yes.
And they rolled up their sleeves and made the beds and cleaned the loos and everything that housemaids have to do. And they just loved it. And we were able to have some of our middle-aged, well, same age as ourselves. Actually, I was 50 when we went there. So, you know, anyone who's 50 now looks really young to us.
They do.
So our 50-plus friends who came with us onto the track really loved it, because one little old lady came puffing up the track to the old Pompolona hut, which we were in by the river, and that's probably the hut you remember, Frank. Mm. Yes, the hut we were in on the Milford track was washed away a couple of years after we left it. It was the river caused a huge slip which undermined the bank above where the hut was sitting above the creek.
Mm.
And it was panic stations for THC, who operated the Milford track at that time, because this happened in September and the track was due to open 6 weeks later. So they did an incredible job in that they cleared a patch of bush about 200 metres higher up from where the old hut had been, and they flew in building materials and erected a hut ready to operate the track in time to open early November. But that was another plus, that we were able to share the sights and sounds of the Milford track. Many of our friends who came and worked there with us.